welcome to another ABC Radio National podcast. For more information, go to abc.net.au/rn.
Hello and welcome to the Philosopher's Zone. I'm Alan Saunders. Now, we're getting into some weird stuff this week in the form of the work of the American philosopher David Lewis, and it's all about how many worlds there are. Well, you might want to say there's just one world, the one we live in. But what about the other worlds that might have happened but didn't? In other words, what about all those possible worlds? The idea comes from the German philosopher Gottfried Wilhelm von Leibniz, who died in 1716. What Leibniz was saying was that God, being perfect in knowledge, was able, before creating the world, to survey all the worlds that he could possibly have created. One of these possible worlds is the actual world, the world that we live in. Some of the others differ from it to a large degree and others to a small degree. The actual world is, of course, the world that God chose to create, and being perfect in goodness, he chose to create it because it was the best of all these possible worlds. Come the 20th century, and this all brings us to what is known as modal logic. Now, possibility is a form of modality, and modal logic concerns itself with propositions that begin with phrases like "it is possible that" or "it is necessary that." Look at it this way. It is possible that Tom Cruise and Nicole Kidman might never have divorced, and one way of putting this is to say that there is a possible world in which Tom and Nicole are still married. Once you accept that, of course, you have to accept that there is also a possible world in which Tom is a motor mechanic and Nicole works on the checkout at Coles. And, of course, one in which Tom is a motor mechanic and Nicole is a world-famous movie star. And so on and so on. All these possible worlds already, and we're just talking about two people. Over now to David Lewis. Or rather, since he died in 2001 at the tragically early age of 60, over to Barry Taylor from the Philosophy Department of the University of Melbourne, talking last year at the Melbourne Writers Festival.
I think it would be fair to say that conversations with David were challenging. And they were challenging for a number of reasons. One was that David had absolutely no small talk whatsoever. And secondly, he had the unnerving habit of thinking before he spoke and working out the answer. He would also concentrate on what you had said and produce a pithy response with no more elaboration than he regarded as necessary. I still remember the first time I met David, which was in fact in Oxford when Linda and I were students there, in 1970 it would have been. I knew David and his work. He was already well known. I'd seen him around at seminars. And I was working on the work of another philosopher called Richard Montagu at that time, whom I knew had a close relationship with David. So when I saw David sitting in a cafe by himself, I thought I'd strike up a conversation with him. So I did. "Barry Taylor," I said, "Melbourne." "David Lewis," he replied, "Princeton." Silence then fell, as it so often did in conversations with David. Desperately thinking of something to say, I said, "What's Richard Montagu up to nowadays?" David paused to think about what I'd said, and then said, "I heard last week that he had been murdered." "Great Scott," I said, or words to that effect. "Great Scott, who would want to murder a philosopher?" David paused to think about it and replied, "He had a private as well as a philosophical life." And that was the end of the topic.
Well, I'm afraid Richard Montagu had indeed been murdered, apparently by a man he'd picked up for sexual purposes, though the case was never properly solved. His importance for Lewis's philosophy was that he too worked on the theory of possible worlds, which he applied to linguistics.
Well, look, there are many stories of this sort emphasising the peculiarities of David, but I don't like telling them, really, since they distort the man. Once you got to know him, these peculiarities vanished. It soon became clear that the main impression that the man left was that of enormous and powerful and frightening intelligence. But he was also a very unassuming man. He was a man who lived austerely. He was a man with a certain gentleness to him as well. Philosophy is often played as a blood sport. Much fun is taken in demolishing speakers. I never saw David do that, even though he certainly had more than the ability to do it, and he must have been sorely provoked when fools stood up and lampooned his theories. I said he was an unassuming and simple man. When he came to Melbourne and stayed with us, he was a very undemanding guest. He didn't want a room, though all visitors normally take one as a matter of course. He didn't want a room. He sat in the small undergraduate library, and there he penned some of the great papers of 20th century philosophy, surrounded by undergraduates. What were the attractions of Australia for David? Well, I think that there were a few. One of them was that he genuinely liked the informality of Australian life. He found Australians easy to relate to, easy to get on with, and that was certainly one of the attractions here. Secondly, it was a long way away. David was a Luddite. He had no truck with email and computers. He would at times stoop to a fax machine, but that was about it. So when he came to Australia, he found that he could be insulated from the pressures of academic life in America and devote himself full-time to writing philosophy, particularly in the period he spent with us in Melbourne. But there was more to it than that as well. It's also true that there was here a congenial academic climate for David. Metaphysics, the area of philosophy in which David was primarily interested, had become rather an unfashionable thing under the onslaught of the philosophers of the first half of the 20th century. A very necessary onslaught, for there's no doubt that metaphysics had gone to excess at the end of the 19th century. But David felt that the attack had gone too far. He wanted to revive systematic metaphysics of a sort that was deemed impossible by the philosophers of the early 20th century, people like Russell, Moore and Wittgenstein. They too had urged the primacy of language and the study of language in the advance of philosophy. David wanted to reject that. Now, in Sydney in particular, there were philosophers who shared these interests, and particularly, we could name here, the philosopher David Armstrong. This was because, largely, of the influence in an earlier generation still of Professor John Anderson at the University of Sydney, a man who had resisted the move towards language of the major philosophers of the 20th century. So systematic metaphysics survived in Australia, particularly in Sydney, systematic metaphysics of the sort that Lewis was interested in promoting. So it was in Australia that he found congenial minds and fertile minds and fertile soil for his own ideas to grow. And so a symbiotic relationship grew up between David Lewis and many like-minded philosophers of Armstrong's and of younger generations.
On ABC Radio National, you're listening to The Philosopher's Zone. And this is Barry Taylor from the University of Melbourne talking to last year's Melbourne Writers' Festival about the strange work of the late David Lewis, a philosopher who believed in a plurality of worlds.
What then were the primary insights of David's philosophy? He's renowned for his embrace of the doctrine of possible worlds, the doctrine that in addition to this world, parallel to this world, there exists an infinity of other equally real possible worlds. The doctrine of possible worlds goes back originally to, was most developed by Gottfried Wilhelm von Leibniz, the 17th century German philosopher, but it had been revived as a logical tool in the 20th century, in particular by Saul Kripke, a man who was to become a colleague of David's at Princeton. Now, Kripke was interested in possible worlds largely, as I say, as a logical tool to understand and to solve various outstanding problems which arise in the logic of modality, the logic of necessity and possibility. He used it there as a logical tool, but it was Richard Montague, whose name's cropped up before, a Californian philosopher and logician, who took the notion of possible worlds and began to use it in the solution of philosophical problems. And it was from him that Lewis took his original inspiration in the development of possible worlds, an inspiration which he used to carry far further than Montague himself had done. Now I want to read a bit from the opening pages of David's book On the Plurality of Worlds. The world we live in is a very inclusive thing. Every stick and every stone you've ever seen is part of it. And so are you and I. And so are the planet Earth, the solar system, the entire Milky Way, the remote galaxies we see through telescopes, and, if there are such things, all the bits of empty space between the stars and galaxies. There is nothing so far away from us as not to be part of our world. Anything at any distance at all is to be included. Likewise, the world is inclusive in time. No long gone ancient Romans, no long gone pterodactyls, no long gone primordial clouds of plasma are too far in the past, nor are the dead dark stars too far in the future to be part of this same world. Maybe, as I myself think, the world is a big physical object. Or maybe some parts of it are entelechies or spirits or auras or deities or other things unknown to physics. But nothing is so alien in kind as not to be part of our world, provided only that it does exist at some distance and direction from here, or at some time before or after or simultaneous with now. The way things are, at its most inclusive, means the way this entire world is. But things might have been different in ever so many ways. This book of mine might have been finished on schedule. Or, had I not been such a commonsensical chap, I might be defending not only a plurality of possible worlds, but also a plurality of impossible worlds, whereof you speak truly by contradicting yourself. Or I might not have existed at all, neither I myself nor any counterpart of me. Or there might never have been any people. Or the physical constants might have had somewhat different values, incompatible with the emergence of life. Or there might have been altogether different laws of nature, and instead of electrons and quarks, there might have been alien particles, without charge or mass or spin, but with alien physical properties that nothing in this world shares. There are ever so many ways that a world might be, and one of these many ways is the way that this world is. Are there other worlds that are the other ways? I say there are. I advocate a thesis of plurality of worlds, or modal realism, which holds that our world is but one world among many. There are countless other worlds, other very inclusive things. Our world consists of us and all our surroundings, however remote in time and space. Just as it is one big thing, having lesser things as parts, so likewise do other worlds have lesser otherworldly things as parts. The worlds are something like remote planets, except that most of them are much bigger than mere planets, and they're not remote. Neither are they nearby. They are not at any spatial distance whatever from here. They are not far in the past or future, nor for that matter near. They are not at any temporal distance whatever from now. They are isolated. There are no spatio-temporal relations at all between things that belong to different worlds. Nor does anything that happens at one world cause anything to happen in another. Nor do they overlap. They have no parts in common. The worlds are many and varied. There are enough of them to afford worlds where, roughly speaking, I finish on schedule, or I write on behalf of an impossibilia, or I do not exist, or there are no people at all, or the physical constant do not permit life, or totally different laws govern the doings of alien particles with alien properties. There are so many other worlds, in fact, that absolutely every way that a world could possibly be is a way that some world is. And as with worlds, so it is with parts of worlds. The other worlds are of a kind with this world of ours. To be sure, there are differences of kind between things that are parts of different worlds. One world has electrons and another has none. One has spirits and another has none. But these differences of kind are no more than sometimes arise between things that are parts of one single world. For instance, in a world where electrons coexist with spirits. The difference between this and the other worlds is not a categorical difference. The worlds are not of our own making. It may happen that one part of a world makes other parts, as we do, and as otherworldly gods and demiurges do on a grander scale. But if worlds are causally isolated, nothing outside a world ever makes a world, and nothing inside makes the whole of a world, for that would be an impossible kind of self-causation. We make languages and concepts and descriptions and imaginary representations that apply to worlds. We make stipulations that select some worlds rather than others for our attention. Some of us even make assertions to the effect that other worlds exist. But none of these things we make are the worlds themselves. So there we are, the thesis that there are an infinity of other possible worlds, very inclusive things, all equally as real as this world. Not things that we make by our imaginings, not things that we make by our conceptualizations, real things, absolutely independent of us. Now, why does David believe that there are all these other worlds? This is just a statement of what he believes. Why did he believe it? Essentially, the argument David propounded is that only with the aid of the possible worlds, only by allowing ourselves to speak of these infinitely many worlds, can we solve a host of philosophical problems and can we devise a systematic, grand, metaphysical account of the nature of reality. David found himself confronted by one objection. He deals with many objections to his theory in his book, but there's one objection that remains. This is one that he takes seriously. It's the argument from the incredulous stare. How can you possibly believe this? The argument from the incredulous stare. I once complained that my modal realism met with many incredulous stares, but few argued objections. The arguments were soon forthcoming. I think that they have been adequately countered. They lead at worst to standoffs, but the incredulous stares remain. They remain unanswerable, but they remain inconclusive. David was worried that his theory rejected flew in the face of common sense. But though he was worried, though he did not wish to be merely perverse, he took it seriously that he was at odds with common sense. But though he believed that, he didn't believe that this was ultimately a strong reason for rejecting his theory, given the other great advantages that he thought the theory brought with it. Here's what he wrote. Common sense has no absolute authority in philosophy. It's not that the folk know in their blood what the highfalutin philosophers forget. And it's not that common sense speaks with the voice of some infallible faculty of intuition. It's just that theoretical conservatism is the only sensible policy for theorists of limited powers who are duly modest about what they could accomplish after a fresh start. Part of this conservatism is reluctance to accept theories that fly in the face of common sense. But it's a matter of balance and judgment. Some common sense opinions are firmer than others, so the cost of denying common sense opinion differs from one case to the next. And the cost must be set against the gains. Sometimes common sense may properly be corrected when the earned credence that is gained by making theory more systematic more than makes up for the inherited credence that is lost. It's not to be demanded that a philosophical theory should agree with anything that the man on the street would insist on offhand, uninformed and therefore uninfluenced by any theoretical gains to be had by changing his mind. Especially not if, like many men on the street nowadays, he'd rise to the occasion and wax wildly philosophical at the slightest provocation. The proper test, I suggest, is a simple maxim of honesty. Never put forward a philosophical theory that you yourself cannot believe in your least philosophical and most commonsensical moments. David thought that his philosophical theory passed that test, and certainly those of us who knew him know that he did believe in his least philosophical and most commonsensical moments. He did believe in the literal truth of the reality of the infinity of alternative possible worlds.
And what philosophical problems are solved by having all these possible worlds? Well, there's the problem of what you're saying when you're saying that a thing exists. One theory is that those things exist that can be quantified. In other words, if I say that Barry Taylor exists, I'm saying that there is an X, that's called the existential quantifier, there is an X such that X equals Barry Taylor. If I say that Barry Taylor exists, I'm saying that there is a possible world that contains him. If I say, speaking modally, that he is necessarily a human being, I'm saying that he is a human being in every possible world that contains him. But, as the philosopher Roger Scruton has put it, if quantification is the measure of existence, then everything exists over which we have to quantify. And if we can't understand necessity and possibility without possible worlds, then we have possible worlds. And if we have possible worlds, then we can apply quantifiers to them, and so they exist. Well, there is a possible world in which I could go on and on for hours about this, but it isn't the actual world. You heard Barry Taylor from the Philosophy Department at the University of Melbourne at the Melbourne Writers Festival, and that talk was recorded as part of the History of Philosophy in Australasia project, now underway at Monash University. The show is produced by Polly Rickard, with technical production this week by Luke Purse. I'm Alan Saunders, and I'll be back next week with another Philosopher's Zone.
You've been listening to another ABC Radio National podcast. ABC Radio National, on air and online, with many of our programs available as podcasts or MP3 downloads. All the details at abc.net.au/rn/podcast.